be saying this a lot. We've got AI on our plate, artificial intelligence. It's very exciting in a lot of ways, but kind of scary in some ways as well. Put a promo. We're going to be doing this show with Kevin Frazier, and there was a comment about AI. Is it dangerous? You know, I think we can point it in the right direction. Hopefully it's not, but there's going to be some consequences and some drawbacks here. How are we handling all this, right? I think we have a ton of questions, and who answered those? Well, I think we all have a part in that. I learned something a little while ago that there is a national framework for AI out of the Trump administration. What's it include? I think you'll like that. There's some seven policy pillars that we'll talk about here as well, and we'll get into it. Labor issues, but also, man, the opportunity that AI does present you in your lifetime. Kevin Frazier, he's the director of the AI Innovation and Law Program at Texas Law, and he previously worked for then Chief Justice Mike McGrath at the Montana Supreme Court. So we got AI on the plate today for the thousandth time and counting on Voices of Montana. I think as we talk about AI, one of the big things we're talking about is work. I've heard some a long range of statistics or percentages of how this is going to impact the workplace, and 18 to 40%. I don't know. Kevin will probably know a whole lot more about that. Creativity, education, what parents should know, I think is really cool. And then one of the things here, too, that this national framework attempts to do is put kind of everybody in the states sort of on the same page, not working against each other. And I think that's vital, too, as we move forward. Let's move forward with our guest today. Once again, it is Kevin Frazier. He's director of the AI Innovation and Law Program at the University of Texas School of Law and a senior fellow at the Abundance Institute. Kevin, how you doing, sir?
I am doing quite well. Thanks so much for the chance to come on this awesome program.
Oh, thank you for coming on. Appreciate that. I was torturing Ken today. My colleague, Bo, next door, he's an Aggie, okay?
I may have to leave. Well, I'm so sorry. There's just lines that have to be drawn.
I did tell him that I was going to give you a real hard time. I was going to torture you the whole hour. I'm not. I just told him that because you know how unstable Aggies can be. So,
yes.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. You've got some chops in Montana, though. I heard you say that. And I'll back up a little bit. Kevin was a guest speaker on a Wednesday conference that we do that comes out of the Frontier Institute out of Montana, too, and just teased this national framework. But then it was said that you had some time in Montana.
Yeah, so very, very fortunately, I got to spend a year clerking for then Chief Justice Mike McGrath on the Montana Supreme Court. So enjoyed my time in Helena, and I'm fortunate enough to have a mother-in-law who lives in Red Lodge, and so I'm up there quite a bit, hanging out and enjoying all the wilds that Montana has to offer, and fortunately too, still have some friends up there. So always happy to come back to the last best place.
I'm happy for you. And thanks for coming on. There's a lot to talk about. If I just ask what's the most important thing that, we need to understand right now about AI, and then maybe, 10 years from now, what's kind of an answer to that?
Yeah. So I think the most important thing is to put this all into perspective. So among technology policy discourse, there's a law we often refer to, which is Amara's law. And Amara's law says that we tend to overestimate the impacts of technology in the short run, but underestimate the long-term impacts over the long run. And I think we're seeing that right now, is that AI is something that's new. In many ways, it's disruptive. In many ways, it's somewhat concerning. And there's sort of a temptation to make it a boogeyman for every other problem we've seen that perhaps even predated this current AI wave. Well, at the same time, we're failing to do the very hard work and the very long-term work that needs to be done to prepare for what the U.S. is going to look like and what the American dream is going to look like, not only in 5 years, but 15 years and even 50 years, given that this technology is going to be around for a very long time.
So overestimate the short-term impact. I think we're seeing that a little bit right now. Markets and investment infrastructure kind of understanding that to a degree. Maybe we talk about that too as we get into peeling into the long-term aspects, because I think there's a lot there, that's going to be subjective too.
Very much so. And I think too, making sure that we have these conversations in a empirically driven, evidence driven manner is really important. Yes. Because we've seen that throughout time, anytime that humanity is exposed to something new, there's a very rational, understandable kind of gut reaction that sees anything that's new as a threat. That's something that's been baked into us. It's hardwired. But really, we want to make sure that we do not err on the side of stopping AI, but instead asking, how do we harness this to actually accelerate the things that we hold most dear, and to make sure that we're recognizing both the harms and risks of AI in a responsible fashion. And that's something we can only do if we slow down and have a deliberative conversation about AI rather than reacting kind of out of that gut instinct or based off of emotions.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that development, technology, our ethics often lag behind those kinds of things. And this is going to be a case, and maybe a very magnified case in that regard. Maybe let's kind of give us an overview of how we're trying to keep up with the ethics.
Yeah. So in terms of what we're seeing right now at the state and federal level, there have been a bunch of fits and starts at the federal level with respect to trying to come up with a clear national approach to AI governance. And that is a big, big problem to solve. And so unsurprisingly, and perhaps as intended, it's taking Congress a lot of time. Something that I have to remind my students of frequently is that Congress wasn't designed to act quickly, right? Its whole role is to make sure that it's not moving too quickly just because the political winds are blowing in one direction. And good policy often does take time. So I will say I think Congress has perhaps missed some deadlines that I would have liked to have seen congressional action by, but it is worth noting that deliberation and a sort of methodical approach is important. And here, what we're seeing is that Congress has been pretty dang active when it comes to hosting hearings on the entirety of the AI tech stack. So if you spend your days watching C-SPAN, number one, I'm sorry, because that sounds pretty boring. But number two, you would see that Congress is spending a lot of its time hosting hearings on a range of topics, whether it's data centers, whether it's privacy in the age of AI, whether it's workforce and education in the age of AI. So it's not like Congress is just sitting on its hands. It is performing that action of trying to understand what are the biggest issues that we're seeing surface in these AI conversations. And a similar discussion happening at the state level, where they are perhaps being even more proactive and turning some of those legislative ideas into actual law.
I'm going to ask kind of a visual question here, and it goes back to overestimating the short term. I think we're seeing, you know, a lot of, communication regarding our short term. So the question is this, how would you describe it? Is it one step forward and two steps back? Is it three steps forward and one step back? Is it, where are we at right now in terms of, I guess, that visual?
Yeah, it's really hard to say what the proper approach to AI governance looks like, which is why, you know, in some regards, I'd say it's three steps forward and one step back. And then the next week, I'll tell you it's the exact opposite. Uh-huh. Because the difficulty here is that the AI we knew in 2023, right, when this was just initially being released to society, that AI is just light years behind the AI we know today. And based off of what we're seeing in Silicon Valley, we're going to continue to experience new and greater AI models over time. And so the difficulty here is that, like I mentioned earlier, legislation is not meant to move at lightning speed. And yet technology is moving at an exponential rate. And so this requires a sort of rethinking about how and when we try to regulate AI. I think there are some very positive examples we're seeing about what may be a good framework to follow. And just to call that, call one example to attention to begin with, in Utah, we see that they are relying on an approach called regulatory mitigation. And this basically involves the state saying, hey, if you are an AI company and you want to serve the residents of Utah and you think you are going to help us address some important issue, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, whether it's mental health, come to us and let's design a unique regulatory regime for your new AI tool. So one example would be there's a company there called Doctronic, which is helping automate the process of medical prescription refilling. And this is a, traditionally costly endeavor and something that adds to the staggering amount of money we spend on healthcare. And here's an innovator coming into Utah saying, hey, we have this AI tool. Let's deploy it. Let's make it available to your residents, but let's make sure we're paying really close attention to whether it works as intended. So we're going to share data with you. We're going to make it easier for residents to share any harms they experience. And that way, we're going through this sort of iterative learning process that is reflective of the fact that today's AI is the worst AI we will ever use. It's only going to improve. And so that sort of regulatory experimentation, I think, is really favorable and really smart.
Kevin Frazier with us, director of the AI Innovation and Law Program at the University of Texas School of Law. But he married well and has family in Montana and does a podcast, too, called Scaling Laws. I'll get into that, too. And there's a lot to get into here in this national framework, which was I guess kind of new to me, and there's some declarations. I want to do that, but let's finish up here with something else that you had said. You know, you want to make this an evidence-driven kind of process, or everybody should make this an evidence-driven kind of process. You know, with AI and the ability to create some deep fakes, it's kind of working against you. How hard will it be to keep it an evidence-driven process?
Well, this is where I think we have to really invest in the fact that having that sort of evidence-driven process requires a lot of resources. We've seen traditionally at the federal and state level, there have been calls for what's known as retrospective review. So retrospective review is something in a statute, in legislation that says, hey, every once in a while, we need to kick the tires of this law and actually see if it's working as intended. Mm. Well, if you don't fund the actual reviewers, and if you don't make continued enforcement of that law contingent on whatever they find, well, then this just becomes a check-the-box exercise. And so this is where I'd really like to see greater state investment and greater federal investment in mechanisms to actually study and capture policy outcomes, because that's how we're going to make sure that we're finding the right calibration between the risks and benefits of AI. One example here would be making sure that we give consumers an easy outlet to report any instances in which they have some problems with AI. So I've called for the creation, for example, of a AI-specific hotline. Think of it as speed dial to your attorney general to say, hey, I've been using this AI tool, and it's not nearly as effective as they allege. Or, hey, I've been using this AI tool and it's hallucinating all of the time. We should make it really easy for consumers to identify and report bad actors in the AI space so that we can make sure we come down with the force of existing law on those bad actors and reward those who are being honest and open about how their AI tools work.
We all have to have our eye on the future here, especially when it comes to AI. What kind of future does AI afford us? Challenges, of course, opportunities, a lot of discussion about it. And we're moving ahead, hopefully, in this, as Kevin Frazier, our guest today, would say, in an evidence-driven kind of manner here, AI moving fast, lawmakers are trying to keep up. We're on that one here today. Kevin, again, I appreciate you coming alongside the AI Innovation and Law Program. He's director of that program at the University of Texas Law School. Kevin, tons of good stuff, tons of questions left to go here. I picked up a little bit on this national framework, and I guess I was surprised. Sometimes I can get a mile long, but only an inch deep on some things, that there was a national framework. And I thought it was maybe kind of like an unwritten understanding, or that there was a framework corporately, or maybe your family has a framework, so to speak. But there's a national framework. And as I looked at this, the policy pillars behind it, I like it. I think it's on task here. Talk about it, please.
Yeah. So the Trump administration released last month a national policy framework for AI that covers what has become known as the four C's. So we have children, we have communities, we have creators, and we have censorship. And then it also addresses considerations with respect to ensuring innovation and America's AI dominance with respect to national security concerns, tackles questions of workforce development, and then make sure that there is a proper allocation of authority between states and the federal government on some of these key AI policy questions. So it's a framework that's intended to really guide Congress as they hopefully move on from just learning about AI and start legislating around AI, because we do need some clarity in this domain that hasn't been put on the table yet.
Is it sufficient at this point? Is it helping?
It is to be determined. Mm-hmm. We are seeing that Congress is definitely taking this framework seriously. So the framework across those four C's that I mentioned includes a number of recommendations that kind of spell out those key pillars in more detail. So, for example, with respect to protecting children and empowering parents, there's a call here for Congress to establish commercially reasonable, privacy protective age assurance requirements for AI platforms. And there's additional calls for making sure that AI tools have mechanisms for parents to be able to determine how and when their children are using AI tools. And so these recommendations are being taken up by Congress in the form of discrete bills and kind of one-off bills. And so fortunately, Congress seems to be taking seriously the effort to try to kind of check the boxes of all of the recommendations that this national policy framework sets forth and make sure we codify them in law so that America can continue to lead in this AI domain.
I appreciate that because, you know, there's a sense of urgency behind it. And with that, we can overlook these kinds of protections that are vital to us. And, you know, as I just examined from that common person, regular gal viewpoint, those things unnerve me a little bit. I mentioned, you know, people will say, is AI dangerous? Well, I suppose it can be, right? So I think there's a sense here too, Kevin, that people feel powerless, that it's going to come on. And that's why I was glad to hear in that last segment, there are programs out there that will empower them. And maybe you can comment on that too. I'm going to pick up into this issue where I think people are quite worried about, and that is labor. I've heard a range of statistics about how AI is going to impact directly and indirectly. I can't make sense of if that's, you know, evidence driven or not. It was like 18% to 40%, and people have different ideas about that. Let's talk about the labor impact.
Yeah, and here again is an area where we really have to resist the temptation to govern by headlines, right? Because you and me and everyone we know has seen some dire forecast of AI bringing about the end of one job or AI destroying some entire profession. And really, when we look at the hard data, we're not seeing that sort of sky is falling mentality. And it's important also to flag that we've been here before. So, for example, I have, in my abundant free time, perused the archives of the New York Times, trying to find an article lamenting the fact that we were no longer going to have horse pooper scoopers because of the advent of the car. And, Tom, I haven't found it. I have not found the article that said, what are we going to do to protect the horse pooper scooper? And yet we used to have thousands of people doing those jobs. Similarly, we used to have folks who were tasked with standing up bowling pins at bowling alleys across the country, right? Then we automated that process. And so this isn't to say that we shouldn't be taking this AI disruption seriously. In fact, I think we need to be taking it more seriously. But it's instead to emphasize that we are going to get through this if we proceed with thoughtful kind of empirically driven, again, policy. And so some of the predictions we've seen, for example, I'll just list two that come to mind first. So the first is that by 2035, so 9 years from now, the current Bureau of Labor Statistics forecast is that we will see overall employment increase by 3.1%. Okay, so we're feeling pretty good about that. That's the government forecast. But then there's a forecast from a group called Metaculus. And Metaculus is a platform of expert forecasters, right? Think about the folks who just spend their time reading everything and anything about new technology trends. And they forecast a decrease in employment of 2.5%. And so we see this gulf in just a span of 9 years of about 6% between what the government thinks may happen and what some expert economists and expert forecasters think may happen. And so, Tom, that invites the question for average Montanans, for average Americans, how the heck do we proceed through this period of uncertainty? And this is where I'm a huge advocate for what I call economic shock absorbers. We need to anticipate that we have no idea exactly how and when AI is going to disrupt specific communities and certain professions. And so rather than try to put AI back in the bottle, how do we create policies that we know will help Americans thrive regardless of what economic future we see come about?
I have a hard breakup coming here in about 2.5 minutes. It may not be enough time to discuss this, but this is a higher ethical and there's real life examples of it regarding labor and job taking, perhaps. Right now, especially in some data-driven jobs, there's AI. People who are working those jobs are training that AI to take over their jobs. Is that a taking? Is that a concern?
I think it's certainly a concern if you know that your employer is actively trying to find a way to squeeze you out. Surely you're not showing up to work with a smile on your face. But it presents a really difficult question, Tom, which is to say, do we try to prevent AI adoption in the workplace? Or do we instead ask, how do we start to create the jobs of the future? And given that we are in a global economy, given that what we're doing today, whether you're in Haver or whether you are down here in Austin, Texas, you're competing against a global workforce. And so we have to be honest about the fact that creating the jobs of the future has to be our focus, because other countries are going to automate and use AI and start to change those professions. And if we're not the ones creating the jobs of the future, then we're going to find ourselves flat-footed. And so this is where I would love to see a greater emphasis on how do we support an entrepreneurial mindset in our students, for example? How do we make it easier to start a business? How do we get rid of some of these occupational licenses that have kept people in protected guilds and limited the amount of competition? These are all massive, really difficult questions that we have to ask so that we can find our way to the economy of the future.
Well, how will things work out with AI? Big question. And there's a lot of questions surrounding that as well. Parental control there. How do parents guide their kids? That's one thing we talked a little bit about, but there should be more on that. National security, economic policy. It's all wrapped up as this moves ahead of us a little faster than perhaps our ethics and understanding. And that's why we're talking with Kevin Frazier today, the director of the AI Innovation and Law Program at Texas Law, also does a podcast called Scaling Law. Hey, Kevin, thanks for coming on. We'll take a call here in just a little bit, and I'll warm up to that here in just a bit. Tell us what the AI Innovation and Law Program is there, and then talk a bit about your podcast.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks for the opportunity, Tom. So the AI Innovation and Law Program is really a reflection of the fact that the legal profession is among the professions that's going to be most upended from AI. A lot of the work we do is pretty rote. It's pretty standardized. It's pretty formulaic. And so when it comes to allowing AI tools to replace a lot of those tasks, well, we're usually ranked pretty highly in terms of the number of professions that are exposed to these AI tools. And so rather than try to prevent our students from using AI or try to prevent the legal profession from adopting AI, here in Austin, we're asking, how can we make sure our students are on the vanguard of putting these AI tools into practice and making sure that they know how to do so in a responsible fashion that not only helps them better represent their clients, but also aligns with the general need to make sure that we're making the justice system more accessible, for example.
Kevin, let's...
And then our podcast. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
You're good. And then our podcast, Scaling Laws, is an opportunity to hear from some of the smartest minds on AI policy. So we've had, for example, Google's chief economist came on and talked about how they see the future of work from their vantage point there in Silicon Valley. We've also had members of Congress come on. Representative Begich from Alaska was a recent guest. And so it's an opportunity to just make sure folks hear from all of the very smart AI stakeholders who are thinking through some of these really nitty gritty AI policy questions.
Well, I know one of those policymakers is on line one for us here. Brad Molnar joins us again, a friend of the program and with the Public Service Commission, and you know, AI and regulations are and energy. It's all going to go hand in hand. Hey, good morning, Brad. Thanks for calling in today. You're on the air with Kevin Frazier.
Well, you bet. And good morning, Kevin. You and I come at this from different job descriptions, I think. You want to talk policy, and I have to handle the outcomes of the policy. And my concern with AI is, A, it's being discussed in absolutely immaterial terms. How do we, you know, parental oversight, children getting in. We've been fighting about that for just standard Facebook stuff for a decade, and we haven't made any progress. So we can talk about that, but the outcomes are probably going to be somewhat nebulous because there's so many ways around them. My concern is on a national basis, a regional basis, and a state basis, that AI promoters, many of which are billionaires and multi-billion dollar corporations, international in scope, are using government to bully everybody else into submission. And that's national. Regional transmission organizations, the largest in the nation, which is called PJM, is under federal mandate to, in 6 months, provide energy, emergency energy to AI centers. They're energy deficient going into it. They don't have enough. So to say we're going to take it away from everybody else and give it to them from under mandate from the Department of Energy is begging for blackouts and brownouts in our industrial sector.
Yeah, that's news, too, so, for us.
Well, and then you go to... far closer, the Southwest Power Pool, which Montana just joined as a member.
Let's stay with this. I know that we can. Yeah. There's quite a vein to go into here. But yeah. You know, Kevin, what's your response to that? I mean, energy is a big component of this. You know, I'm not sure it's all evidence driven. I trust Brad and what he's saying, obviously. But you know, your comments on do we mandate this? And again, keeping states' rights and keeping it all on a level that doesn't pick winners and losers as we go forward.
Yeah, it's a really important question. And thanks for flagging it, Brad, because I share the same concern that we need to make sure that we are respecting state authority when it comes to important zoning provisions, when it comes to making sure that they have enough energy for basic necessities and for their own residents. And so I think that the president's inclusion, for example, of the rate payer protection pledge in the policy framework is something that Congress should act on to make sure that we're not seeing hyperinflation pass the costs of their immense energy needs on to consumers. I'd also love to see more states follow the lead of Oklahoma, for example, where Oklahoma recently allowed for behind-the-meter power generation so that these hyperscalers and other data center operators can create sources of power right next to their data centers in a way that stresses the grid less and requires less from the rest of us. And then finally, I'll just add that I highly recommend you all take a recent listen. Sorry, I'm a shameless podcaster. Tom, but I highly recommend you all take a listen to a recent episode we did on scaling laws with a gentleman named Gavin McCormick. Gavin McCormick is the leader of an organization called Watt Time. And he has a really interesting perspective that shows that a lot of these hyperscalers are coming up with really novel ways to make sure that they are training their models in a way that can actually be improving the grid functionality. So in California, for example, the utility operators there are actually learning from the hyperscalers about how to better manage their grid. And so there's a real upside here if we make sure that there's collaboration between the hyperscalers and the regulators so that we don't unnecessarily burden the grid and instead approach this from a strategic long-term perspective.
Brad, a couple of minutes here for a follow-up if you want.
Sure. If I might be so bold, none of that means anything to me because I'm looking at what's happening in the states around us and what is happening in Montana. Northwestern's Energy, very recent filing for a large load tariff, which even they admit is data centers. I can't say a lot because it's a docket in front of us, but the people I've talked to have said that it appears as though we will be working the rest of our lives supporting data centers if that thing passes. So you can talk about Oklahoma. And I can talk about Virginia, where they said, we're tired of this. Where Iowa said, we're taking back the welcome mat. Where Idaho said, we're not going to have any more tax breaks for these guys. We don't want to incentivize them. So it's not about a podcast, sir.
Thanks.
It's about what is actually happening. That's what is important.
Well, and I don't know. Thanks, Brad. I appreciate that. And I think there was a lot of valuable information in there that things are being considered on the table here as well. Kevin, let me ask you this question about, mandating this. I think a lot of people feel that there is some real national security concerns and the future of our economy also tied up into this. What's the feeling nationwide? I mean, isn't there going to be states have typically pushed back from mandates from the federal government? And if they don't, it's generally, been to their harm.
So this ultimately comes down to a question that we actually considered way back before 1787 when we ratified the Constitution and we were dealing with the Articles of Confederation. Sorry, I can't resist the temptation to do a little bit of legal history on this May 1st. So under the Articles of Confederation, we had a lot of states that would have preferred to kind of exercise their complete authority over questions of national significance. So for example, things got so bad under the Articles of Confederation that we actually had the state of Connecticut ban ships from New York coming into Connecticut's ports. And for obvious reasons, that wasn't great for the economy. We saw a economic collapse almost on scale with the Great Depression occur under the Articles of Confederation. And so our response was to say, let's create the Constitution. Let's create a central government that is capable with respect to questions of national security and with respect to questions of economic prosperity, that we make sure we have a central government that's strong enough to handle those questions. Now, I very much understand that we need to have a truly national approach to data centers to make sure that we're not repeating instances of prior reliance on a handful of states to bear the burden for the rest of us to make sure that we can pursue some new technological ambitions. But we also need to make sure that this doesn't become a sort of area in which single states have to be the data center hubs for the entire country. So for example, let's just play a quick hypothetical. Again, as a law professor, it's my mandate to do this. So imagine that Maine passes a ban on data centers, which they almost did. The governor vetoed that legislation that was passed by the legislature. Now let's imagine that New Hampshire and Vermont do the same thing. Then New York, then Virginia, then Florida. And suddenly we start to see that, there are only a handful of states that are now being asked to bear a national burden, which is to say to be the hub of all of these data centers upon which we rely. We wouldn't be using our phones. We wouldn't be using the internet. We wouldn't be able to have electronic health records if it weren't for these data centers. And so it's really not a question of if we're going to see more data centers. We are. We have to have a thoughtful and nationwide perspective on this that manages to hear local voices and hear local perspectives while also making sure that we don't repeat the past and place the entire burden of this industrial build-out on single states.
Thanks for that. And you just got one, too, from one of our members of the Public Service Commission as well. And I appreciate Brad being a consumer advocate in this regard, too. So there's a lot of things that will tie into the input going forward here when it comes to AI. Kevin Frazier, boy, it just goes so fast here. I got like 2 minutes now. Do you want to hit the right to compute thing? Because I know Montana's been thinking about this and trying to get out in front of it.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this. This has been an effort from the Frontier Institute in particular in Montana championing this issue, which is basically to say that when we see the state legislature regulate something like AI or more generally access to computational resources, we really want to make sure that the state legislature has done their homework. So traditionally, when a law gets challenged, it is reviewed under what's known as rational basis. And when a court reviews a law under this rational basis review, they basically ask, can we come up with any reason? And when I say we, I mean the judges. Can we, the judges, come up with any reason why the legislators may have thought this would be a good idea? So it doesn't even require that the legislature has actually done its homework. Instead, the judges get to go off in la-la land and imagine a reason why that law was enacted. Well, under the right to compute, this would instead subject laws pertaining to those key rights of using new resources like AI, like, let's say, 3D printers, like the internet more generally, making sure that those laws are going to be held to a higher standard, which is to say that they're actually advancing a compelling government interest, that they've been narrowly tailored to advance that interest, and that the legislature considered less burdensome alternatives. And so this is a really positive development in making sure that we do what we've been talking about throughout this entire hour, Tom, do that sort of thorough, evidence-based regulating. And I think Montana's been a real leader in putting that right to compute on the books.
When do we have something more than a framework?
Oh, well, if I had the answer to that, I'd be making a heck of a lot more money, Tom. But I think that we are going to see some real action from Congress before midterm. I think that the people have been very clear that they want Congress to step up and provide a clear set of standards around AI. Folks are rightfully concerned that this is a transformational technology that is yet to have a clear national response. And so,
Kevin,
I'm optimistic that Congress will act.
Awesome. Thank you. Good stuff. I appreciate it. I'm going to have you back on if you're willing. Okay, sir?
Sounds great. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.